Hi everyone, this month on the podcast I've got with me Rispa Genga Ohagat. Rispa is the CFO of EABL, East African Breweries Limited. She's the CFO of CFOs, right? So nice to meet you, Rispa, and thank you so much for agreeing to be on the podcast. My first question, you're a girl from Canada. I'm trying to say it correctly. And you've really excelled. You're very well known, very well recognized in Kenya. You've had a long history in auditing and in banking. Do you surprise yourself at how well you've done?
Hi, Jerry, and thanks for having me. Surprise? No.
Okay.
I was always a dreamer, and my sisters laugh about it now. Every time I wrote a composition, I'd describe a house. It was nothing like that. But, you know, I'd really describe it. I'd say we have horses and swimming pools. We didn't have any of that. But I was always a dreamer.
Yeah.
Not just about material things, but about impact and about wanting more. Mm-hmm. And I think in a sense, then it doesn't surprise me. I am more grateful, I think, that I've been able to do a lot of the things I've been able to do so far.
Yeah. Did you work hard or did it come very naturally to you?
I think it's a combination. It's definitely a lot of hard work. Mm-hmm. From an early age, I always tell people I wasn't a good girl. I was problematic. I was curious. I was adventurous. I was rebellious.
And rebellious? So I can't imagine you being rebellious at all.
I was in trouble a lot. So really? I got the fair share of the beatings.
Really?
But I figured that the one thing I was good at was school. Mm-hmm. So I just learned very quickly that if I'm good at something and I focus on that, I may not get everything else. But if I just put my mind to that, then I have a decent chance of success. So
Did you think, financial freedom comes from putting your head down, getting it done, excelling in school? That was the only route, right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what our parents told us. That's what their parents told them. Mm. I'm a second born in a family of seven.
Oh, I'm also a second born, yeah.
that's the rebellion. I was always questioning and, wanting to know why and not just towing the line.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And then when you were in school, was it definitely maths related, not the artsy side, I guess?
Yeah, I'm not artsy, but I'm very linguistically astute.
Okay.
So languages come naturally to me, but particularly English reading. I love reading. I was good at maths. I was good at sciences.
So all around, artistic, very good.
But I wasn't I couldn't draw sing.
Well, neither can I, to be honest.
Yeah.
I can sing though.
Yeah.
But I could. I don't know about that. Yeah. Okay, cool. When I watched your Engage talk, because I had to do a lot of research, and to be honest, all of the videos online that I saw were financial audit reports, which obviously I wasn't going to sit through. But the Engage talk, you talked about your dad and how he was the first feminist in your life and really showed you just because you're a woman, that doesn't mean you're incapable. And I think my dad is also very similar, a great role model for me. Yeah. What was it in him? Was it his own background that led him to become the feminist? What was his particular draw?
I don't know. I suspect it's his background because he also lost his dad at a very early age.
Yeah.
And so he was raised by his mom and by various people. But also he had us three girls to start with. And, he needed to affirm us. And I think we were very, very close to him. So it was so important for him that we drew strength from him. I do think a lot of it is really credit to his mom, to be honest.
Yeah. What was your mom like then? If she had a feminist husband, what was she like?
My mom was amazing. I really looked up to her. My first memory of her must have been when she was back. So I must have been about
when
six
she came
or
back,
seven.
Because she went, for anyone who hasn't watched the Engage talk, you should. Mm-hmm. But she went, Rispa's mom went to Canada to study her master's and left her and her children, essentially Rispa and her sisters, with their dad, who really championed and looked after them in the interim. I mean, if you're talking about the 70s, is it 70s, 60s?
Yeah. Well, late 70s.
Late 70s. It would have been very rare for a man to agree to, his wife traveling abroad and leaving three children. But now I guess people take it for granted.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in those times, I can definitely resonate with that. What was she like?
Yeah, well, if you think about it, it was probably late 70s. Yeah. So telephones weren't what they are today. So
were there even telephones in the home?
There weren't there.
There was just the public ones.
They were just public phones. So mm-hmm. so Dad would get us to speak into a tape recorder.
Wow.
And post it to her by snail mail. And then she would post, you know, her response back. We didn't even know who was that or what she was
saying.
And
then it would take weeks.
Yeah, it would take weeks. Yeah, it would take weeks for her to hear back from us. And she used to tell us she would cry.
Gosh.
Because she left us when we were so little.
Yeah.
But my first memory of her coming back, first, I didn't know she was our mom. She was just so pretty. She was poised. She had a car. She had beautiful hair and she wore fancy clothes. And, you know, for me, we just thought that's a pretty auntie. And it took a while for us to realize that's actually our mom. But my mom is smart. She's like super smart. I think my dad is smart, but my mom is like super the real smart, brains. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She's very poised, very calm, never raises her voice, but very, very wise. I always knew that, you know, if she wanted things to go a certain way, my dad might say it, but actually she's the one that made things happen around the house. She worked until she was 70. She eventually did her master's. She started out on a PhD. She didn't finish. She was nearly 70.
Gosh.
But, you know, she's ambitious.
Yeah, my mom just finished her PhD and she's 70. So she just did it. Yeah. Yeah.
Also determined. So she's hardworking, so determined. I feel like, though, that she was caught between, because Dad let her go, she owed him. So then, you know, she came and had four more kids just to make him happy.
But four more kids was not an impediment to her then continuing.
You know? In a sense, it was. Mm-hmm. Because the choices she made thereafter were jobs that were safe, that kept her near the home, that gave her a house, and therefore she could house the children. So she did, I think, and I feel, give up some stuff because she needed to get that balance. She needed to raise the kids. And so in hindsight, when I look at it, she could have been way more, but she chose to invest in us. She chose to give more of herself to us.
And I guess you haven't repeated that because you have done, I mean, you've gone all the way to the top.
Yeah.
Is it, you know, when we look for reasons for people's success, a balanced family life and parents who are encouraging and supporting you and showing you by example is definitely an advantage as well. Do you credit that stable beginning to your ability to then, you know, push yourself?
I think so, though. Growing up, I sensed a lot of mom guilt in her.
Mm-hmm.
I sensed that she wanted more, but she gave it up. And I think she reminded us sometimes.
That is very honest.
Yeah. And I grew up saying that, you know what, I want to do what I need to do for me, but also be there for my kids. I kind of want a bit more.
Yeah.
And for her generation, she had pushed really hard to even do what she had done. But I sensed that there was something in her that wanted more, but felt that she couldn't. My dad had sacrificed, so she needed to hold back and she needed to give him sons, and, you know, there were more daughters coming. So I feel like there was a sense that she's happy with her choices, but I feel like there was a sense that she could have been done more.
Yeah.
And so I, in having my kids, I've always said that I don't want to give up because of them. It sounds bad, but
no, I think
I want to try and go for everything I can go for and still be there for them.
I think it's something that people may overlook now because of time has passed so much and people are free to do what they want, or seemingly free to do what they want. So when it came to you and your decisions, how are you making them? You were definitely going to be an auditor, an accountant. Was that the path?
No. The choice to be an auditor and accountant was interesting on two fronts. First, my dad is an accountant.
Oh, okay. He was an accountant. Okay.
Yeah. And when I got to fourth form, I didn't really know what I wanted. I was trying to figure out what do I do?
Yeah.
And I figured, let me do something I'm good at, which is linked to maths, and maybe gets me a salary early because there were other kids to be taken care of. But the real turning point was when I said I wanted to be an accountant, my dad said, man, that's hard. You can't do it. It's hard. I'm doing it and it's hard. And for me, that was, well, I'll show you.
I'll show you.
I'll show you. Okay. And then on the back of that, I got a scholarship to Strathmore. So that helped me get started. So, yeah, so just going that route was more expedient than choosing what. It was very practical, yeah. Nothing romantic about
it. But I mean, that is so interesting, because is there like a fire burning in you? Like, I mean, I can't imagine there's a fire burning in you to do accounting. Is there another fire burning in you?
Yeah, because I always say that you've got to find deeper purpose. And I think for me, it was somewhere around 2007 in the post-election crisis when I started to ask myself, what's my life really about? What's my purpose? What's my impact? And in that moment, in that questioning, I did a program that they had at church called Mizizi at the time. It's now called Fearless. And it does a lot around unpacking you as a person, and what are you good at? What are your strengths? What are you passionate about? And in that process, I figured out that I'm really all about people. Whatever I call myself, accountant, whatever it turns out to be, if my occupation does not help me impact people, then it just doesn't quite make sense.
Oh,
so
see.
As long as I'm impacting people in some way, then that's what I am passionate about.
And you definitely do. I mean, you're doing it at the biggest company, one of the biggest companies in the East African region, not even in Africa.
Yeah.
But when you started off at Barclays, correct?
No, I started off at KPMG.
KPMG, yes. And then Barclays.
Then Barclays.
Yeah.
Yes.
So when you were at KPMG, and you know, you were junior then, still junior at Barclays, what is the thing that made you stand out as a professional, that made you climb the ranks? What do you think your talent was? I mean, aside from the numbers.
I think I'm good at what I do.
Yeah.
I make no apologies for it. I'm really very good at what I do. I apply myself. I go after the things that I want, and I ask for them. I don't wait to be handed. I put up my hand and say, can I do that?
Mm-hmm.
And can I do the other? And can I experience this and the other? But more importantly, I had my first body, my first year of work.
How was that?
In hindsight,
was it like, I mean, you're not going to tell us it's a whoops, but
of course it was.
Yeah. Were you married
that
at
wasn't
the time?
The plan. That wasn't the plan. I wasn't married at the time.
Wow.
We've been dating for like 4 years, but I just started working. So clearly that wasn't the plan. And at the time the audit firm, they were quite strict. You didn't even talk about having a child if you're a man.
Seriously?
So you couldn't even talk about it. And I remember we had a medical policy, a medical scheme that was self-funded, and under the title pregnancy, it had something that said pregnancy is self-inflicted, therefore it shall not be covered. So you knew you didn't have babies around here. And here I was, all of 24 years old, and I'm having a baby. And but I think
what did your parents say?
Focus. They didn't know for a while. And when they knew, they knew. My parents were very strict. You didn't go to lunch with someone they hadn't met.
Really?
Yeah. So, because they said, well, if something happens to you, we need to know who to call. So, of course, they knew Peter, who's now my husband. So they knew him, they'd met him. They knew we were seriously dating, but they were like, what will people say? You have to get married right now. And I was saying, wait, I need to figure this out fast. And so here I am having the baby, having the job, very intense job, lots of late nights. But I feel like that gave me focus, because I knew very early on that, you're going to be walking. This is a lifetime journey, so you're going to need to make it work. But more importantly, I think, is Peter being there. And he always jokes that he knew I was on a mission when he met me. So, he kind of knew this mission, either you're on board or get out of the way.
Get off early.
So he's very involved as a parent, very involved as a partner in everything. And working together just made it a lot easier. So I think it gave me, having a child at that age, just gave me a sense of focus, purpose. I needed to catch up. So, I needed to make sure that every moment counted.
Yeah.
So, just double worked hard.
And I guess it's a good moment to reflect on the fact that you weren't going to be your mom in terms of like limiting yourself just because you've had a child.
Yeah.
Okay, so that focus and purpose then led you to promotion after promotion after promotion.
Yeah.
You then made the decision to leave Barclays and join, is it EABL directly?
No, I went, I joined, that was KPMG. So from KPMG I joined Barclays, but yeah. I loved KPMG despite, you know, their medical policy. I loved it because it really gave you a good start, you know, both technically, leadership skills, your exposure. You got trained on presentation skills and properly hammered into it. You got the technical training, but it was also a great place to work. People cared about you and, you know, I could bring my kids to the office and, you know, you could say, I want to try this, and the opportunities were there.
Okay.
They weren't stuck on ranks. So if you worked hard and you delivered well, you could get a double promotion.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And so that for me was a really great place to work. And I loved it. I enjoyed my time there. I did nine years.
9 years.
So yeah, of very many different things. So also the dynamism was great. So then I joined Barclays. At the
and is that, that's when you went to South Africa?
No, so I joined Barclays first in East Africa. At the end of the financial crisis, they were building up risk teams. I didn't initially want to move, I remember, because I remember even telling the guy who recommended me for the job that I'm not looking, I'm quite happy here. And when they talked to me initially, I said, no, I'm not really interested. Then they came back and said, well, we've expanded the role, we've made it more senior, we've given it a lot more depth, would you consider?
What was the role?
I was heading audit for East and West Africa.
Okay, so it's a big role.
So it was a big role. It was a big role. I didn't realize how big it was. I was all of, I think, 32 years old. So sitting on the executive team.
Wow.
And on the boards in East and West Africa, building up a team.
Reporting, I mean, that is very, very young.
Yeah.
Honestly, what was I doing when I was 32? Not that.
Yeah, but it was a huge, huge responsibility. Yeah. And I think I didn't realize it again. That how big it was at the time. Didn't help that I was pregnant again when I joined up. But yeah, it was fantastic experience. Again, the attraction was in one of the conversations. They said, well, we don't have talent in Africa. And I was like, wait, we have talent in Africa. I shall find it.
Yeah.
And so I did that Kenya for 3 years. In 3 years, I'd built a really great team, lots of energy. Everybody was asking, what's going on over there? We moved from not delivering a single thing to delivering the audit plan, but also having fun while doing it. And at the end of the 3 years, then I was itching to move. But I also remember when I joined up, I was really quiet, seemed quiet. And my boss always, I had an Irish boss, and he always used to tell me in one-to-one, you've got amazing ideas. You've got things going on. And then you come into this meeting with the leadership team and you're quiet. And he said, you've got to speak in every meeting. Even if you're summarizing or just debriefing, say something in every single meeting. So he'd make me say something. And every time I went to London, he'd make sure I met the senior leadership. And he'd tell me, look, I've scheduled meetings. Go and speak to them. So in one of those meetings, I met the group chief internal auditor. He, the previous year, had been voted the best auditor across globally. Yes,
because I'd done some, my gosh.
I'd done some rework on some report and he thought, wow, who's this? And you said, so met him. And so when I met him and we were sitting having a conversation and I asked him, what would it take for someone like me to head audit in Africa? And he looked shocked because I think first there's this image of you just had a child, where are you going? And he asked me, oh, would you be interested? And I said, yeah. I mean, I've done this with the team and, you know, we're doing really well. I've got great guys who are ready to be promoted. So I need to think about the next role. And I didn't know it at the time, but the role was being moved from Dubai to South Africa. Typically, they used to bring guys from the UK as a training ground for talent.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, this conversation that was a chat became an interview. And he started tossing questions at me. And here I was answering them. And the next thing I knew, I had interviews in South Africa, interviews in the UK. And later I was told, people even told, don't apply. We have a preferred candidate. And that's how I ended up taking the job, moving to South Africa at the time. Barclays and Absa were buying each other.
Yeah, yeah, at the time they were together. We're still not, I mean, we're there with the excellence in terms of technical delivery. And I think that is very clear.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what are the skills, soft skills? What is it that makes your team energetic to work with you, or even convincing people around your way of thinking, talking to someone and getting the job? What is it that you bring to the table? How do you do that? I think if someone is listening to this and then they want to know.
I think for my teams, what I like is to build a vision very quickly. So when I got into Barclays, everyone that came into the team was, we don't really want you in our team, but we don't know how to get rid of you.
Yeah.
So just go and sit over there. And I came in and I remember one of the guys saying to me that I've been in this bank since you were 3 years old. The first thing I did, I came, it was November, December, and we had a plan for the year. We hadn't even gone halfway.
Mm.
Everybody had lots of leave days and they were just totally demotivated. Mm-hmm. And so I said, go off on leave. Everybody go on leave. And they thought, you're mad. I said, well, we don't have a chance of finishing the plan. So you might as well take leave. Mm-hmm. But in that moment, I started to think about what's my vision. Why did I take this job? And I said to them, I want us to be the team that everybody wants to work for because we do our job well, but we have fun doing it. That involved doing some changes in the team. So there's also some heavy lifting. You don't get that easy. There was some heavy lifting involved in getting new people into the team, the ones where they are working with them, getting them fired up to want to be there, and just getting everybody focused on if anyone hears about this team, they want to come here and find out what's going on.
I mean, I really like that idea because it bolsters people. It makes them proud to be associated. Exactly. Yeah. Even that concept though, and not everyone is confident enough to execute at such a young age. So how do you get that confidence? Were you always a natural leader? Were you always very visionary? I mean, aside from making up stories, what is it? Is it just your style?
I don't know. I suspect I always did want to make a difference. But I also feel that a lot of the exposure at KPMG was a big part of that. I was never a high school prefect or primary school.
Okay, but so I was the prefect.
I wasn't, but I was very influential. When you talk about the people who have
behind the scenes
power, that was me. I would be able to convince people to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's in harnessing that for good that kind of came through.
Yeah.
And it was the same wherever I went, whether I was leading the teams in South Africa or Zambia or Mozambique. It's really about getting to the heart of what's important to them and then how do I get them to want to be a part of something special.
Mm.
And once you've locked that, then you find that, you know, people want to work there. They want to work with you and for you. They want to deliver the vision. And then they grow, which is also a nice thing. And they see other people growing and they want that.
They want to replicate it. Yeah.
Yeah.
They want to be you, Whisper. They were like, I need to look up to this. Okay. So
be better themselves. Yeah. My boss in South Africa used to say, I don't know what you do over there in that corner because you're tough. There's no slacking on results, but everybody's like super happy and, you know, having a blast doing their work. Yeah, but that's really
a very special talent for anyone who is in leadership.
Yeah.
It's extremely difficult to balance both being tough and also, encouraging and motivating your team.
Yeah.
So you moved to South Africa then. How was that experience?
At first, it was tough. Mm. I remember thinking I didn't know I was black before.
Before you went to South Africa?
Yeah, I'd worked in Barclays and, you know, we used to have these intense training sessions with people across the globe and it was so competitive and you'd have assignments and interviews with actors and, you know, you got feedback and you were scored. So I was competitive, but never had I thought of myself as a black person. Not that I didn't know I was black, but being so conscious of your race.
Because it's another lens between which you're judged. It's not the same as winning a competition.
Yeah.
It's winning a competition while being black.
Yes, and because of the historical injustices and just the environment, you know, just the dynamics in South Africa, you had to be very aware of first that you're black, but you're not black of South Africa black. Yeah. You're black of immigrant.
Is that worse? It's worse, I think.
I don't know that it's worse. I think it's just different because then you'll immediately be put in a box. And I went in again at quite a senior level. And it was a tough time. It was transition. And I went in with my feisty Kenyan-ness, you know, I, not knowing I'm black, going into boardrooms and just voicing my thoughts.
Yeah.
And everybody looking at me like, who is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And quickly realizing that, wow, okay, this is different.
Yeah.
Also part of being in South Africa, still is now, was transformation. So making sure you have people of color in the business. And I wanted to do that the right way, not as an apology or as tokens, but I wanted to do it the right way. And so it involved me getting leaders that were black and were inspirational, convincing them to come on board, buy into my vision that we can do something special here. And then getting in people who would also buy into that vision and contribute and deliver.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was a really special team. I remember a lot of them were young women. They had their babies and... You know, we started doing flexi work and I said, look, this is a big thing because if we abuse it, it's going to be taken away. So we've got to use it responsibly. If you've got an emergency, who do you call? Not your manager, call your friend so that they cover for you and you cover for each other so that we keep the whole thing working. And that way we'll be able to take care of our families and do our job and do it really well. Yeah. So I think just that was also, again, painting that picture, but also caring for what mattered to them. So South Africa was tough in some ways, but also really great. In terms of financial services, way more advanced than Kenya. So I was able to see products that we don't even have here. Services are easily accessible. You know, stuff works.
Yeah.
You pay your taxes. If you've overpaid, they send you a check or they credit your account.
Yeah.
You know, so stuff works. I think the family side was tough because my husband gave up his job and came. With. Yeah. And my kids had to do the adjustments. My eldest was 11. The second one was 6 and the little one was 2. And
2?
Yeah. Gosh. Yeah. And they had to have this massive adjustments, different accent.
Yeah.
And parents, them a lot more involved, a lot more extracurricular activity. So just settling into that and finding my place and just being confident in voicing my thoughts regardless of what colors were around the table, I think was a tough thing. I tell people it's maybe it takes you a year to settle into a new country. Yeah, but again, very grateful for the experiences, for the knowledge, for the impact. Yeah.
And how long were you there then?
I did 4 years.
4 years and then came...
Really, the last year I spent most of it in Mozambique. I did an assignment in Mozambique and then came Zambia.
And then came Zambia.
Yes.
And that was for how long?
Zambia was another 4 years.
Gosh. And Zambia, I mean, one of my best friends is from Zambia, but to be honest, it's not the most exciting location.
We loved Zambia. We did still you? Do. Yeah. My entire family. So Zambia was important because... When I was in South Africa, I realized South Africa is very specialized. And if I stayed, I'd go on to be the chief internal auditor, which is what I was in Kenya. So what had I really grown?
Yeah.
And so I started to think about a map back home. It was also important because my hubby had left his job and we needed to figure, we thought it would be short term.
Yeah.
And we needed to figure that out. And so I started to think about what's a path back home and ask myself, what am I good at? What did I study? And I said, let's give finance a shot.
Yeah.
And so I got down, did a gap analysis of what do I know, what don't I know, put up a list of stakeholders to go and talk to. And
is that the level of preparation that you do generally?
That's me, yeah.
Gosh, a gap analysis.
Yeah, I put down, what does it take? What's the JD of a CFO? Yeah. For where am I? On which areas? Yeah. How do I bridge that gap? I can take a secondment and spend some time in another team. I think the toughest thing was convincing people because I'd gotten to quite a senior level. I was a managing director in audit.
Okay.
A finance director with a level down.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody just thought I was crazy. What are you doing going a level down? Well, I was saying it might be a level down, but actually the breadth of the experience and what it offers me in terms of a return home makes it worth doing. Yeah, but it took a lot of convincing to many, many people to give me that chance to actually step back.
So then
back.
When you went to Zambia, you went as a CFO?
I went as the finance director, CFO.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
Yeah, but it took somebody actually saying, well, I'll take the chance on her. And I had to say, they said, well, the role is a grade down. And so well, I earned the grade. I'm not stepping down.
I love it.
Yeah, I earned it. It's a universal grade. We are tested across functions. So Why should I take a downgrade?
Okay.
So I'm not taking a downgrade. Neither am I taking a pay cut. So I found this one boss who believed in us.
There's so many things you were saying, but it's like a quiet toughness that I'm seeing.
Yeah.
Like a determination.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this one boss thought, man, okay, let me give you the chance. And so I moved to Zambia. My eldest had to remain in school in SA.
Okay.
My second born joined her eventually. But Zambia was probably the best place we've ever lived.
Really?
Yeah, there's an earthiness to it. They still have old school values. People are very nice, very communal. I used to think Kenyans were friendly. When I came back, I thought Kenyans are not friendly at all. Zambians are super friendly. There's no Christmas we spent on our own. We were adopted by families.
Nice.
Their grandparents were my children's grandparents. Mm. And it was simple in a sense.
So, it is unspoiled in that way.
Yeah.
Okay. And then now,
EABL. So 4 years in Zambia, again, reaching the end and thinking what next. And at the time, ABSA, now we were switching to ABSA. And the proposition on the table was to go back to SA.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really struggling with that. I knew I didn't want to go back. I wanted to come home. They didn't really have a clear role. And so it was such a struggle. At one point, they asked me to go to Botswana and my heart was just breaking. I'm not moving my kids to yet another country. I told my husband we'd come back home.
Yeah.
So it was tough. It was tough. That transition was tough. Not as tough because ABSA had a job for me. They're saying, look, come, we've got a role for you. And when the one you want opens up,
then you can get it.
But it was hard. Mm. And in that process, EABL came calling just a few weeks, like 2 or 3 weeks before I packed up and left for South Africa. And we went through interviews really quickly. And in no time, they had an offer on the table and we were coming home.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so we got back on December 31st, 2019, which is my mom's birthday.
Wow.
And so it was great to be back. We'd been away for a while, 8 years in total. And in the process, my husband had lost his dad. We were feeling, the parents are aging, we're missing our siblings. So we really wanted to come home. So it was an answered prayer in a sense.
And I guess the other thing is that it was a transition for you from working for international businesses, KPMG and Barclays, into now a Kenyan business, right? It's fully Kenyan.
Well, EABL is actually 65% owned by Diageo, which is a UK business. So it's still multinational in a sense, though I find that the industry is a lot more flexible.
Yeah. I guess it's seen as a Kenyan business.
It is, but it's listed locally and we have local shareholders and we have local products. But it's no different to Barclays, to be honest. They both have foreign majority ownership.
Yeah.
But I think what they've done is the local business really identifies locally. So it's not different in that sense.
Yeah. I think they still
same
have standards, a very,
same.
Yeah. For you from a professional perspective, I guess it's still international standards. It's just seen as more of a Kenyan brand.
Which is a nice thing.
So you're now CFO at EABL. Mm-hmm. What does your day to day look like? What is the things that you do? How do you do them? How do you manage? You've got teenagers now.
Well, young adults.
Young adults, yeah.
Yeah, my eldest is now 24. Gosh. And I have a 20-year-old and a 15-year-old. Mm-hmm. So they're grown.
They're grown, yeah.
Yeah, so how is it? There is no typical day in my life. And that's throughout my career, which I love. Because I get bored easily. So I'm always, even when I stay in organizations, but I move around and explore all the opportunities in the organization because I love learning and I get bored really quickly. What's my work day like? Mm-hmm. It varies. Mm-hmm. It depends on the time of the month, but I cover a lot of things. I do a lot of strategy and defining where's the business headed. How does that add value to shareholders? What kind of returns would that be? What kind of things should we invest in?
The returns. People are looking for the returns.
Yeah. What should we invest in and what should we not? And what gives us that balanced set of returns? I also take care of the treasury, so raising capital for the business. We issued a medium-term note back in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
Dividend decisioning, working with the banks, dealing with FX and interest rates, all of that sits with me. I also manage performance for the subsidiaries, making sure that we meet our commitments when we say we'll deliver X to the shareholders, you know, pulling all corners to deliver that. Managing cost, managing investors. So all the conversations I have are for investors, shareholders, and business people. Mm. So managing that side of the conversation as well. Managing my team as well, recruitment.
How big is the team?
So we are very, we've got a lot of global outsourcing operations.
Okay.
So we've got a distributed team across the globe. But here I've got, my core team is 11.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got finance teams in each of the subsidiaries,
okay.
which are sizable. Yeah, I would say roughly 60, 70 maybe.
Wow.
Yeah.
Has the decision paid off in terms of changing from audit to now becoming a chief financial officer?
Yeah. I mean, I changed to chief financial officer when I went to Zambia.
Yeah.
And I think what it did was give me a lot of breadth and a lot of experiences that I didn't have before. I've done quite a number of things, and I think that is really, really...
So the decision was good?
It was good. It was good because audit, you kind of tell people what to do, but you don't really know what is involved. Now, on this side, you actually have to do it and
because
see the results.
It's commercial.
It's solutioning. It's managing. I do manage tax, which is also a big part of our lives. So, yeah, so it is quite... I think payoff is a strong word, but... I think if you think about me and what I look for in every opportunity is growth. So definitely I have grown.
Yeah. Let me ask you, where is the next frontier then?
Oh, God, I hate that question.
Why? Why?
Because who knows?
I'm sure there's a gap analysis being done right now about where you're going.
Well, who knows? That's the thing. I think for me, it's I think I still have a lot to offer. I always say I want to go beyond finance into broader general management, but you know,
you do.
Yeah, but you know, it depends on what falls where the chips fall. But yeah, who knows?
I can't wait to see. Now you're also involved in, you're a non-executive board member for INM. I'm sure you sit on other boards as well, but I noticed APA as well.
Yeah.
You know, you've reached the level where you're a board member. People are calling on you to be the person, the C-suite executive that we need. What do you think? First of all, for people who want to be on boards, what is the specific thing that they need to do? How do they manage to get on the board? And what do they do when they are on the board so that they can flourish?
How much time do you have?
we can have all day.
No, so I'll try and keep it short. I don't always know that people know what they mean when they say when they want to
they
be
want
on
to
a
be
board.
On boards, yeah.
Yeah, because getting on a board comes with a lot of fiduciary responsibility. And if you're not well informed around what you're taking on, it could actually be quite problematic. So people understanding first, why do you want to get in there? Is it just to put it on your CV or why? Once you're clear on why, as with any other job, I always ask, where can your strengths play best? For me, my years of risk management, I spend a lot of time with boards. A lot of boards are about risk management. Mm. They're about strategy. They're also a lot of risk management. So what I really bring to the board is both strategy and risk management. Mm. So I ask myself, how can I contribute here? And that's what I look at as well. So you have to know what is your core competency. A lot of boards will do a skills matrix. They typically will need people with governance of some sort. Mm-hmm. So equip yourself. Know some governance.
And have you done like courses on governance and stuff?
I mean, when you're chief internal auditor, governance is your life.
Yeah.
Like, literally, that's what you do.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew it like the back of my hands.
Yeah.
I attended one. I remember it was a 5-day course program. And I just kept thinking, gosh, I have to do this for 5 days. And there was an exam at the end.
Gosh.
And I got a distinction.
Why am I not a prize recipient?
Yeah, but it's because it's stuff that I do. But it's things like don't be financially literate. Like you'll be approving financials. You have to understand them. You don't have to be an expert, but equip yourself with what do I need to know to be effective in this board? And then, you know, there'll be areas, there's some which have different subcommittees. Then you can play a role in the subcommittees. But I think there's still a lot of room. I laugh because in both the boards I'm on, I'm described as young. And
You are young.
Well, I'm always like, yeah, well, relative. My kids think that's really funny. And at EABL, I am not young because average age is under 30. So I am a dinosaur. So, but I think there's still a lot more room to get more diversity in the boardroom. And it's not just gender. It's different skills. It's different voices. Different ages. I think there's still room for that. But you have to equip yourself because I say it's a governance body. You can't run away from the fact that it's a governance body.
It's not just a nice to have. I think it's a serious responsibility. Okay. When I was listening to one of the talks, you were talking about EABL and being a sustainable business. What is, you know, when I imagine EABL, I don't imagine sustainability being at the forefront. But since you mentioned it, I was interested to know, what does that look like for you guys in terms of ensuring that you're, is it green or is this ESG compliant?
So it's a lot of things. It's actually, when we do our strategy, sustainability is at the core.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on a number of fronts. The first front is from a diversity and inclusion perspective. Simply because when we're in manufacturing, it was historically male, strong.
Yes.
Yeah, so we have to be quite deliberate around having a diverse workforce. Mm-hmm. Diverse in terms of gender, in terms of abilities, but also in terms of thinking. So mm-hmm. we are quite clear for our staff, but also for beneficiaries of our projects, our suppliers, our farmers. We're very, very targeted
mm-hmm.
in that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first pillar. The second pillar, which is very important given the type of business we're in, is responsible drinking. So we invest a lot in saying our product is good if used for the intended purpose mm-hmm, and used mm-hmm. properly.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't, then it has unintended consequences. So we spend a lot of time on teaching about drinking, not how to drink properly. We would like you to drink.
What is the secret to drinking properly?
Drink less, mm-hmm. Drink better, not mm-hmm. more. Mm-hmm. So it's drink good quality
mm-hmm.
in moderation and you're good. Don't drink and drive. And we teach, like my youngsters, we have a course called Drink IQ. I get my kids to understand how hydrate, eat food properly.
Where are these courses?
It's online.
On your website?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because they will encounter alcohol somewhere. I want them to have the knowledge.
And in fact, another thing I noticed, which is interesting, is when I was looking research on you and I looked at the website, I had to enter my birth date.
Yes, because we don't allow underage drinking as well. So that's part of that as well. Mm-hmm. So it's a big part of our agenda because we understand the industry that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
But the third part, which is actually the biggest part of sustainability, is green to glass sustainability. We use a lot of water. We use power. So making sure that we are very, very efficient in our operations. We recycle as much as possible. We replenish. We also reduce our carbon footprint. One of our biggest investments in the last few years was in biomass capability, where we moved away from heavy fuels to burning, you know, waste material to generate steam for the factory, which has really worked well. Also on water recovery to recycle our water.
Mm-hmm.
We spend a lot of money on those as well and time to make sure that we're well invested in those. The other element is also just packaging, moving away from, you know, non-sustainable types of packaging for our spirits products. Now we have a recycling of the spirits bottles, which is to be disposable. Mm-hmm. We have a project called Rudisha to bring them back, clean them, recycle, reuse,
mm-hmm.
and make sure they're still at the right standard. And, you know, we're quite passionate about this.
I mean, it's extremely interesting to hear from my perspective. It's always legal.
Yeah.
What am I supposed to do legally to comply?
Yeah.
But looking at it from your view, it's more of how can I reduce my costs at the same time as complying, and complying in a way that makes my business more efficient. So you're looking at it from a different perspective, but same goal kind of.
Yeah. And for us, it's beyond compliance.
Yeah.
It's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
We've been here 100 years. If we're going to be here 100 years, we've got to be responsible about water usage. We've got to replenish. We've got to be carbon neutral. We've got to make sure our consumers are drinking responsibly.
Yeah.
We've got to support diversity and inclusion. So for us, it's not even a compliance requirement. It's a business imperative.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
Also, I wanted to talk to you in terms of like looking at where the business is going. sustainability being at the forefront. How do you think, you know, the impact of the riots, the change in, you know, accountability, especially from young people demanding it, how will that impact your business? How are you looking at it? Because all of us will be called to account, and, you know, some faster than others. what would you say is your report card on that?
I guess it's again back to the pillars of sustainability. A sustainable business does the right thing. Mm. Are we doing business the right way? And that's something we ask ourselves consistently. Are we doing business the right way? And if we are, yes, absolutely, we are. But I think it's a quest that we always look out for and say there are things we don't compromise. And we're very okay with the outcomes of that. So in a sense, for me, it's again, a governance question. Are you doing things right? Are you being fair? Are you, you know, are you creating? Being transparent? Are you being transparent?
Yeah.
And I think we do everything we can to operate our business responsibly and in the right way.
How are you managing, especially with the growth of AI and AI tools and, you know, someone can do the whole accounting thing in 2 seconds using ChatGPT, although I don't know how to use it myself. how are you doing it?
So for us, it's we see it as an addition rather than a replacement. So it's more around how can we be more efficient so that we can spend our time doing stuff that really matters, that really makes sense, making decisions rather than crunching numbers. So areas like forecasting, it's very easy to build it. To build a focused AI that's more efficient. Mm-hmm. Areas like collections. So it's quite a number of areas. I think we even have an AI mixologist now on the site. So people are doing really, we're doing really creative stuff around it, not just process wise but also to appeal to consumers. But we are broad, usually on the cutting edge of new stuff. We're very innovative as an organization. And so I think that really,
well, you have to be to survive 100 years.
We have
years.
To be again, as usual, we have to take care of risk management. So a lot of the tools we use are in-house to our own AI as opposed to open AI.
Correct. I think that's where most people are going, building their own models.
Yeah.
What is your outlook for 2025? What are you looking forward to? What are you thinking? What are you?
I wish I knew.
No, you're a planner.
At the beginning of January, we've had to see in 2024. But I think I still remain optimistic when I look at our country and even some of the stuff that's been disruptive, it's a positive sign that, you know, we're engaged, we're involved, we're not aloof. I do think the economy is tough and, you know, we're under immense pressure financially as a country.
When the economy is tough, do drinking levels rise is the question.
No, and you'll see it during COVID, you know, decline. What people tend to do is they go lower and lower and drink cheaper. And sometimes exit and go into the illicit stuff, which is not a good thing. But you feel it. You do see it.
Okay.
Yeah.
From your career so far, which is going to be a long career, I don't know where you'll be president of the country. I don't know.
No politics. No.
What has been the highlight for you?
I think, gosh, there's lots. I think there's a lot of, and given, you know, my career, there's not many exciting things that happen. But I think the most recent one that I still call out was when we issued the medium-term note in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
We were coming into the market after a number of corporate failures. So the nerves were there.
Yeah.
You know, my board was very, very, very on edge. And, you know, going back into the market at that time was a very tough call. At the same time, pricing it right and making sure that, you know, we're giving investors a fair price, but we're also getting interest, a fair price. Yeah. And that we attract interest. I had literal nightmares because Kenyans are Kenyans. There will be 7 days to apply for the thing. Day one, there's nothing. Day two, there's nothing. And remember, my board has told me, if it is undersubscribed, you're dead, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't say you're dead, but you know, you knew the consequences. Mm-hmm. Day three starts to trickle in. Day four, slowly trickling in. By day five, you cannot sleep.
And day six, seven,
everyone, all of a sudden, the thing is breaking down and it's 300% subscribed. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous. Yeah, so we had to actually give people back
the
money because it was too much.
Gosh.
Yeah, we needed 11 billion and we got something
are
like
32
billion. No, well, the advantage is we got that money priced at about 12.25%.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The rate's now upwards of 20% and it was fixed.
Mm.
So, I mean, it was such a high for my team. It was a lot of work, a lot of work. But landing that, it ended up winning an award in Cape Town. Yeah, for just, you know, doing that. So that was a big one. The teamwork involved, the level of risk involved, and just stepping back, thinking through the level of persuasion and influencing that this is the thing we need to do. And then the outcome that, you know,
that you were
spot on in terms of how we thought about it. So I think that was a big one.
Mm.
There's many other big ones, but that was definitely
I mean, there must highlight. Be so many highs. Yeah. What about the lows?
Lows. Ooh. I think the lows and I'll be a bit more general, is when my lows are normally when I feel my integrity is on the test.
Mm.
Because I'm in finance, I carry fiduciary responsibility. So there are things I have to hold the line on.
Mm.
And when that is being tested, that's intense.
Yeah.
I think also the second low is when I take a risk career-wise. I've moved countries. And then I don't know where my children will go to school next year, in which country, because, you know, those kind of moves come with risk. And so they won't always know what role will be open when for you to go into whenever. So you're coming to the end of your term and you just don't know. And you've got children and they're looking at you and you don't have an answer and you drag them over here. So I think it's always when it touches something personal to me is when the lows come in. If it's technical, we'll fix it. You know, you'll have another chance tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, Whisper, you've done so well. I want to talk to you about tips and tricks for working well in your practice. You know, you're the one who knows.
Yeah.
What is a good auditor? For anyone who's listening, who's in audit, what is the thing? I mean, you've talked about risk.
Mm-hmm.
You've talked about being aware of your fiduciary responsibilities and corporate governance.
Mm-hmm.
What are the other things that you would say, like technically maybe, or something soft skills that you need in order to be a good auditor?
I think first, foundationally, you just have to know your stuff. And that requires experience. Mm-hmm. There's nothing else.
Time.
Yeah, it requires putting in the time.
You didn't need a lot of time in order to Excel.
I slogged 9 years. It's not Excel. There's a lot of judgment involved in a lot of what we do. Because you've seen when a company goes down and the auditors have been asked to account for themselves, it's the toughest thing.
Mm.
So it carries a lot of responsibility and a lot of the need to really understand what you're doing. So I think first is just getting your foundational technical skills is not even a question.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is there's a fair bit of influencing.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the times, if you're an auditor, you'll be landing a tough message.
Mm-hmm.
How do you land that? And I always laugh because Aidan Mohammed was my boss for a long time. And he always used to tell me that, you know, you come in with bad news for me. But then by the time you're done, I feel like I should say sorry to you for putting you in such a difficult place I should really have not put you in that position. So I think, and I don't always get this right, but just that skill of landing the message, influencing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also tell people the third thing.
When you're doing that, does it mean that you're coming with the bad news, but also a solution at the same time, or things that can be done?
You do, yes. Yeah. But remember, you're the independent auditor and, you know, you're just giving it.
Yeah.
You do, yes, but the onus is really on them to do it. But I think for me, the other thing is also I tell people not to major in the minors, because sometimes you're so in the weeds that when you stop and think about the importance of what you're saying and you spend so much time on it, is it really worth anybody's time? So just separating the real issues from the noise, because you can really be reputationally damaged by focusing on stuff that doesn't really move the dial.
Mm. Okay. What about work-life balance? You've talked about being a mother of three young adults, having a husband who made a sacrifice, serious sacrifice for you. Yeah. How do you manage to have a work-life balance?
I don't know.
Or about not.
Balance.
Yeah.
But I always say that it's so important to be partners, especially if you're going to have kids. It's really important.
The first question is, where do you find the partner?
I've not been in the market for so long.
Yeah.
But I think you've got to know what counts Because I think a lot of the times when we're dating, especially us women, we look at the superficial, and that kind of doesn't last. So I think for me, it's look for the stuff that will last, that you can see still being consistent when you're old.
Mm.
And then really have a partner.
Where did you meet?
In campus.
Okay.
Yeah, so you have a partner who will, you'll support each other.
Mm.
And there isn't like, I cannot eat anything other than my wife's food. I mean, it just can't work.
Yeah.
So I think understanding each other, supporting each other, and there are people who've worked through that kind of thing, but not for me.
Yeah.
And also leaning on a wider network. People sometimes think you have to fix everything yourself. You have to feed your kids. You have to put them to bed. But I'm like, sometimes just accept the help. Like, maybe you need a few house helps. It's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah, maybe sometimes your sister can come help you. My sisters have been very instrumental in raising my kids.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's okay to ask for help.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Any other tips for that you would think, you know, someone might want to know?
I think I always say ask.
Mm-hmm.
People don't know if you don't ask. They're not in your head.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not trying to manage your career for you. So you've got to ask. And I tell people, if they say no, you're just where you are. So why are you afraid? So ask.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm big on that. I'm big on asking. I'm big on doing the hard stuff. Think about your organization. What problem needs solving that no one even wants to touch?
To touch that one.
Yeah, go do that. And when you do that, it puts you on the spotlight. Of course, you can fail, but you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it puts you there in the limelight where people are like, here's somebody who made a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think thirdly, just being true to yourself. Yeah, just being true to yourself.
Yeah, I mean, you seem to have managed it so effortlessly. Thank you so much, Rispa, for being on this podcast. I want to do the quick fire round with you. Did you read the questions?
I hope I did.
Of course you did.
Of course I did. I'm Rispa. I read everything.
Yeah, of course.
And I write notes.
Beach or city holiday?
Beach.
Where?
In Mombasa, Zanzibar.
Why does everyone say Mombasa? There are other beaches.
Diani is so beautiful.
Yeah,
Diani is beautiful.
Favorite place to visit?
Favorite place to visit?
Is it most romantic place to visit?
Oh, God, no. My house.
Oh, God, no. Your house. I love it. Apples or oranges?
Apples.
Pizza topping of choice?
Oh.
They're going to tell me I don't like pizza.
Pepperoni.
Pepperoni. Favorite drink?
Gin and tonic.
Really?
No judges.
What type of gin?
Tanqueray Sauvignon.
An expert in that as well.
Well, I knew nothing about gin or anything before I started this job.
Don't tell me that you didn't drink before you joined the ABM.
No, I did drink, but I drank wine, and that was my first big mistake. Because I was asked, "What do you drink?" I said, "Wine." They're like,
"No, go do research
on the company."
That's very funny. Yeah. Rispa, you've been a great guest. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me.
Thank you. Talk
to me. You're an inspiration for many, many women in this country, and long may that continue. Take care of yourself.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
See you guys next month. Take care.